We're in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. Before we start that, does anybody want to talk about the Aggies beating number one Alabama? What a game. Well, we have some electrical work being done, and I'm assuming that it's associated with that. It's mood lighting.
Right.
So I think that's what it is. So yeah, we're it's a big project. You may have noticed that they were replacing all the lighting with LED lighting. They've been in the foyer, all the classrooms, that big workroom back there. They're going to replace these too. And because one thing with these sorts of lighting, the ballasts go out quite a bit. Our workforce is aging, and of course we got people getting older who could replace them, Reuben. And but anyway, the LED lighting will help quite a bit. So we are in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, and remember the first six chapters were things that Paul was addressing based upon what he heard of from the household of Chloe. And so we know what that was, that there were some divisions of who baptized them. There was the fella in 1 Corinthians 5 that was fornicating with his father's wife. There were some civil matters, but starting in chapter 7, are things that they wrote about. Let me suggest this to you, that the letter that they got back was not the letter that they were expecting. Because they'd written a letter to Paul asking about things in 7 through 16. So marriage and we continue a little bit with fornication and meat sacrificed to idols and the Lord's Supper and the resurrection. And all those things were things they wrote about. So they were expecting a letter that addressed that. And so when we think about when Paul wrote this letter and how he constructed it, he could have started off with the things that they wrote about, but he didn't. He started off with the things that they heard about. And so the first six chapters are about admonishment, because they had some problems. And then chapters 7 through the end are about instruction and education based upon what they wrote about. Just an interesting way of looking at it, at least for me. Another thing that would be good, and I think I'm going to assign this to you, Larry, is to maybe reconstruct the letter that they wrote to Paul and ask what questions that they had. And if we look, for instance, just at 1 Corinthians chapter 7, one of the questions had to be, is it okay for the husband and the wife to refuse sexual obligations to each other? And what about virgin daughters? And what about marriage, divorce, and remarriage? And so that would be an interesting thing to look at. So with those thoughts in mind, we're going to start 1 Corinthians chapter 7, which leads with this, now concerning the things whereof you wrote. So they had written, people in Corinth had written Paul a letter. And he says, it is good for a man not to touch a woman, but because of fornications, let each man have his own wife, and let each man have her own husband. Let the wife render unto the wife her due, which is talking about her sexual obligations, and likewise also the wife unto the husband. Wife have not power over her own body, but the husband. Likewise also the husband hath not power over his own body, but the wife. So, that's one of the questions they had, was if a wife or a husband could refuse their sexual obligations to each other. And so Paul says, and he leads with this, it's best if you're not married. Now I've heard some preachers say, well, that old Paul, he's just an old bachelor, and he was never been married. But for certain reasons that we'll read of later in the book, there's going to be some trying times. And he's going to say it'd be better if you didn't have a husband or wife. But he does say this, because of fornications, let each man have his own wife. And so there's a lot of things we're going to look at in this. But basically, the way he answers the question, those sexual obligations, you have to be faithful in those. Verse 4, The wife hath not power over her own body, but the husband, likewise also the husband hath not power over his own body, but the wife. Defraud, holding back the sexual obligations, is, he calls it defrauding. Defraud ye not one the other, except it be consent for a season, that you may give yourselves unto prayer, and may be together again, that Satan tempt you not because you're of your incontinency. So one of the bottom lines for Paul is that you marry if you can't hold yourself pure and keep out of fornication. Now I would suggest to you that there's a lot of other reasons to marry besides that. I mean, God created marriage, right? He created Adam and Eve. You leave and you cleave. And a lot of wonderful blessings in marriage. But Paul is focusing on this aspect that he doesn't want Christians, and God doesn't want Christians, just having casual sexual relationships with whoever they may meet.
Rob?
Yes, Ricardo? The other thing that we see in Ephesians chapter 5 is that the relationship between a husband and wife is compared to the relationship between Christ and the church, and what that should be like. So you, in that sort of comparison, you learn from the church, you learn a little bit about what marriage should be like, and from marriage you learn a little bit about what church should be like. The two should become one flesh. We're one flesh with Jesus Christ. And for me, it's sort of a preview of the unity and the oneness that we'll see in heaven. So the problem must have been that this happens sometimes, and I don't think it means you're like sexual slaves to each other. He did say that by consent for a season or prayer, that's the reason that you could hold yourself back from that sort of relationship. And so obviously spiritual things like holding yourself back for a season of prayer or a vow to the Lord, but it has to be in agreement with the spouse. So it's a problem sometimes that husbands and wives will get angry at each other, and they will weaponize the sort of sexual relationship and hold it over somebody's head. And that's not the way it's supposed to be. Nor is it that the husband and the wife could be so demanding that they say, okay, you know, we're going to do this right now. And the wife, you're in subjection to me, and you don't have any choice. I don't think that's what it's saying here. So, kind of an uncomfortable subject to talk about, right, Larry?
Not really.
Not really, okay. It is for me. So he concludes in verse 5, but this I say by way of concession, not a commandment. Yet, I would that all men were even as I myself, who did not have a spouse. Howbeit each man has his own gift from God, one after this manner and another after that. Okay, and so that's the verses 1 through 7 then are about the sexual obligations that a husband and wife have to each other. Beginning in verse 8 then, we see his instruction on the different categories of those who are not married and who are married. He said, but I say to the unmarried and to widows, it is good for them if they abide even as I, that is, single. But if they have not continency, let them marry, for it is better to marry than to burn. So this thing, burn here, different ideas about that. One is, if you're stuck in the sin of fornication and that you could burn in hell for eternity, or this could be talking about the burning desires that a man and woman have for each other. Verse 10, but unto the married I give charge, yea, not I, but the Lord, that the wife depart not from her husband, but should she depart, let her remain unmarried, or else be reconciled to her husband, and that the husband leave not his wife. So our first instruction in the Gospels, in the New Testament, is with Jesus, right? In Matthew 19, that marriage is forever. And the only thing that could break a marriage is adultery. And that's the only reason you can remarry, is if somebody, a wife or a husband, commits adultery, then the other one is permissible, according to Jesus in Matthew 19, to remarry. All other reasons for divorce are not permissible to allow you to remarry. That's a big problem in our day and time, especially with the permissiveness of our society. People divorce left and right for any reason. So here, but unto the married I give charge, yea, not I the Lord, but the wife depart not from her husband. And this is, so what we see in the New Testament is further education about the marriage relationship. She's not supposed to depart, but Paul says, but if she does, let her remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband. So there can be all kinds of reasons, I suppose, for divorce. And I don't think that God wants, for instance, a woman to be in a marital relationship where the husband is abusive and beating her up every day. I don't think God expects a woman to take a beating every single day. And so she may depart from him and remain unmarried, or she may depart from him and divorce. But according to this verse, she's supposed to remain unmarried. And we don't find that in Jesus' teaching. So this is knowledge that the inspired Apostle Paul is further explanation. But to the rest say I, not the Lord, if any brother has an unbelieving wife, and she is content to dwell with him, let him not leave her. So one of the questions must have been, well, what, I'm a Christian, and my wife is not a Christian, can I divorce her and marry a Christian? Some question like that. But Paul says, if you've got an unbelieving wife, and she's content to dwell with you, don't leave her. And the husband that has an unbelieving, and the woman that has an unbelieving husband, and he is content to dwell with her, let her not leave her husband. So, advice in both cases. Verse 14, for the unbelieving husband is sanctified in the wife, and the unbelieving wife is sanctified in the brother. Else were your children unclean, but now they are holy. Before we talk about that, one thing we need to look about at and think about in this whole discussion is verse 39, which says a wife is bound for so long as her husband lives, but if the husband be dead, she is free to be married to whom she will. So that's the covenant relationship that a husband and wife have with each other. You're bound because you've made a vow to each other and a vow to God that you will live with each other as long as you live. So that's the overlying principle. All right, now let's look again at this. And some of these things I'm not going to be able to explain to your satisfaction, but or to mine. The unbelieving husband is sanctified in the wife. And sanctification means what? Set apart. Like a holy nation, a holy people. So the unbelieving husband is sanctified in the wife, and the unbelieving wife is sanctified in the brother. That doesn't mean they're Christians, but it does mean that once you've made vows with somebody who may be not a Christian, I think that relationship is sanctified and set apart, and you're amenable to those vows. Now, this last part, else were your children unclean, but now are they holy. They would be unclean, I think, if they were born out of wedlock. A type of uncleanness. Mark, what do you think about that?
I think you're doing good.
Antia?
I would definitely put it as they are prepared for God.
Prepared for God?
Prepared, yes. Because there's one Christian there in the home that they're
And then we also see, I think it's either in one of the Thessalonian letters or a letter Timothy wrote, that a wife, over the course of time, can convert her husband due to her behavior of subjection. And so that process can't work if you decide, but my wife's not a Christian or my husband's not a Christian, and they're holding me back, so I'm going to divorce them so I can focus on the Lord. That's 1 Timothy 2. Thank you, Mark. So they're sanctified in their union. It's a holy union, whether you're a Christian or not. Whether you're a Christian or not, you've made a vow to God, and you've got to hold that vow, and it's got to be sacred, and not just abandon it. And there's a lot of cases in young marriages, and I've been familiar with so many of them, that they make a vow to each other, and I've counseled people and performed the weddings even, and sat down with them and said, you understand this, right? Because you're making a vow to each other and a vow to God. You cannot get divorced. He doesn't want you getting divorced. There are reasons to divorce, but you're bound to this woman, and if you get divorced for reason other than adultery, you cannot marry. You understand that, right? You go, oh, yeah, yeah. And one of them called me one time and said, I'm going to divorce my wife. And I said, for what reason? We just don't get along. And I said, well, I would suggest you try to work on that as hard as you can, because you're about to make a decision that could affect you for the rest of your life. So you try to work through that as best as you can and don't give up. And he said, well, I'm a divorcer. We're going to do that. I said, you realize this, if you do, you can't ever remarry again. I understand that. And then years later go by, and all of a sudden get a little attention from a woman and decides he wants to marry the woman. I find out about it, and I call him and said, you remember what we said when you married and when you were divorcing, and now you're doing this? And he said, well, I don't agree with that teaching in the Bible. So it's a big problem. It's a huge problem. It is our obligation as elders in the congregation to sort of police that. And if we've got some members, for instance, we had some members, and they weren't married, and then we found out that they were living together, and so we talked to them and said, it's not right, and you can't be living with this woman outside the vows of marriage in this sort of condition. And so they decided to go somewhere else, which is fine. Here, elders in a congregation, if we're made aware of those situations, we're going to deal with it. We're going to talk to them in a gentle way, and try to show them the importance of respecting vows to each other. Okay, now, verse 15, yet if the unbelieving departs, let him depart. The brother or sister is not under bondage in such cases, but God hath called us in peace. Some people will interpret this and say, if my unbelieving spouse decides to leave, I'm not under bondage, I can remarry. No, you can't. Because remember, in verse 39, a wife is bound for as long a time as her husband lives. So what does this mean? I think what it means is that you're not in bondage in such cases. It's not your fault. If they want to leave, you let them leave. God's not going to hold you to that and make you accountable for that. You're doing your best. You're trying to get them to stay. But they're bullheaded, and they've got a mind made up, and they're going to leave. The Christian is not under bondage and not guilty for that thing. Still required to abstain from being married again, I guess, unless the spouse commits adultery. And most times they will. Most times when marriages break up, there's a third party involved. Not all the time, but most of the time. So you hear somebody divorcing, the first thing you should think of is, is, has one of them found somebody else? And most of the time, the answer to that is going to be yes. Verse 16, for how do you know, O wife, whether you shall save your husband? Or how do you know, O husband, whether you shall save your wife? Because that's your goal. If you're married to somebody who's not a Christian, that's your goal, right? And it brings up the whole other ball of worms, is should a Christian marry a non-Christian? My dad did, and worked out. I think it's okay for Christians to marry non-Christians, but there's so many pushing and pulling in that marriage relationship that you want to have as much commonality as you can have. And so if in a young marriage the husband is going to one church and the wife is going to another church, that's a bad deal. And we had some members here. You know him well. I won't call any names, but he was really devout Catholic. And she's a member of this congregation. And they had two sons who grew up in this congregation. He eventually, became a Christian. One of the things that he said was that, as he would say, his prayers, they were just formulas, you know, just really short things. But he'd watch his sons pray, and they're praying a different prayer than what he would pray. And every time he'd want to come to church and just visit and just to learn the Bible, somebody would trash the Catholic Church, and then he'd get mad and not come again. But then one time, when I'd built a relationship with them, and he said he wanted just to learn the Bible. That's all he wanted. He didn't want to change churches. He just wanted to learn the Bible. I go, fine. Yeah, we'll start a class right back here. We'll learn the Bible. So we studied through Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, Acts, Romans. He was baptized in 1 Corinthians. You hear what I say? Once you know the Bible, you can't, and if you respect God's word, you're going to do whatever, you're going to follow the truth. And so there's so many little things going on there. His sons praying and so anyway. But the bottom line is that, and she was so dutiful and faithful about coming to services, and it takes time that a husband can convert the wife, but it takes time. Sometimes we're too impatient for that, but we've got to follow the path of a wife being in subjection and honoring her husband, but being true to the Lord. Okay, verse 17. Only as the Lord has distributed to each man as God hath called each, so let him walk, and so ordain I in all the churches. And so this is the calling wherein you were called. And people will misapply and misinterpret this as well. So Paul is saying that whatever position you're in, socially perhaps, when you become a Christian, he's not calling them to change those relationships, like a Christian being married to an unbeliever. So the examples he gives, beginning in verse 18, was any man called being circumcised, let him not become uncircumcised. So this is not talking about that minor surgical procedure. It's talking about what circumcision represents, which is being a Jew. And being not circumcised represents being a Greek or a Gentile. If he had been called an uncircumcision, let him not be circumcised. Circumcision is nothing. Uncircumcision is nothing but the keeping of the commandments of God. That each man abide in the calling wherein he was called. Were you called being a bondservant or like a slave? Don't worry about it. Don't care about it. No. Even if you can become free, use it rather. So he's saying that if you're a bondservant, if you're a slave, you've got a master who's not a Christian, don't think that, okay, I'm a Christian now. I can run away. So we have the story about Philemon and Onesimus, right? But Paul says use that. And as a bondservant then, you could do, and as a Christian bondservant, you can do a lot to convert your master. And just by the honorable way that you act. Most bondservants or slaves are going to run away. be lazy and do other things, you know, sort of a passive aggression towards the master. But here Paul says, use your position as a bondservant to, what's implied here, is to convert your master and his family. Verse 22, for he that was called in the Lord, being a bondservant, okay, so being a bondservant to Jesus Christ, is the Lord's freedman. Likewise, he that was called being free is Christ's bondservant. So we're all in a bond. Once we become Christians, we're all under bondage or slavery to Jesus Christ. And so what he's saying here, in my opinion, is talking about the relationship and how you ought to act. 23, you were bought with a price, become not bondservants of men. Okay, don't sell yourself into slavery or servitude. Brethren, let each man wherein he was called, let him abide in God. And so the overlying message, the purpose of these verses, is to say that if you become a Christian and your wife is not a Christian, then you stay in that relationship and have patience and be the sort of person you need to be. God will take care of all things. Any thoughts to this point? Okay, now concerning virgins, I have no commandment of the Lord, but I give my judgment. Okay. This is a little hard for understand in our culture today. But fathers in those days had a lot more power in their families than what we have today. And so a lot of times there are arranged marriages. And they could control the daughter and keep her from getting married. And it was the headship of fathers in those families was a lot different than what we see today. Just keep that in mind as we read through this. Now concerning virgins, I have no commandment of the Lord, but I give my judgment as one that has obtained mercy of the Lord to be trustworthy. I think, therefore, that this is good by reason of the distress that is upon us, namely, it is good for a man to be as he is. And so here's this distress that we've talked about. It'll be called other things as we read on. But there's some things going on in society that in that day and time. And it could be, I mean, it certainly would be persecution. And so like if some bad guys get you and say you're not married, and they're going to say, unless you recant your faith in Jesus Christ, I'm going to kill you. And you go, okay, go ahead. But if you're married, and they say, unless you recant your faith in Jesus Christ, I'm going to start chopping fingers off your wife. And I'm going to cut her nose off and her ears off and all that. And she's crying and things like that. Then that's a bigger deal, right? And because you love her. So there's a present distress going on. And those sort of things happened, by the way. And we live in a much more peaceful time. So the current distress that upon us, so it's good for a man to be as he is. And this may be talking also about AD 70, which last week Julie pointed out I called it AD 40. But it's AD 70 when the Roman armies were going to totally disrupt that area and be killing people and persecuting them. Verse 27, are you bound unto wife? Don't seek to be loose from that relationship because of the present distress. He's not saying that. Are you loose from a wife? Seek not a wife. But should you marry, you've not sinned. It's just Paul's advice. That because there's going to be some things going on that's going to be better if you were single. And if a virgin marry, here we are back on the virgins, if a virgin marry, she has not sinned. Yet such shall have tribulation in the flesh, and I would spare you this. So the verse 26, the distress that is upon us, and then here at the end of verse 28, the tribulation in the flesh, he said, I would spare you. But this I say, brethren, the time is shortened that henceforth both those that have wives may be as though they had none, those that weep as though they wept not, those that rejoice as though they rejoice not, those that buy as though they possess not, those that use the world as not using it to the full, for the fashion of this world passes away. And so he says, what he's saying here is all these circumstances that are happening right now, the present distress and the tribulation, it's just going to be for a short time, and then the world's going to pass away. And so what is he talking about here? He could be talking about the end of the world, although maybe in God's eyes that's a short time, but in our eyes we wouldn't say that it was a short time. Or it could be talking about AD 70, when God, through the Roman armies, destroyed Judea, decimated them, and took the remainder captives. Of course, they were warned in Luke 23 and 24 that when you see the Roman armies coming, get out of town. But not everybody listens to those kind of things. 32, I would have you to be free from cares. He that is unmarried is careful for the things of the Lord, how he may please the Lord. But he that is married is careful for the things of the world, how he may please his wife, and is divided. So also the woman that is unmarried, and the virgin is careful for the things of the Lord, that she may be holy both in body and spirit. But she that is married is careful for the things of the world, how she may please her husband. So just a general thing. If you're single, you can focus 100%, figuratively speaking, on serving God. But if you've got a wife or a husband, you've got to serve them in a certain respect, right? And so he calls that, Paul calls that not as good as being able to be single like he is, and devote everything. So Paul could jump up and take a boat to Spain or do anything he wants to and not say, honey, I need to go to Spain. Is this okay with you? So you can see that sort of distraction. And
this version uses anxiety instead of cares. And that word affects me more because we understand what it is to be anxious about
things. In verse... anxiety, right. Yes, that's a good word to think about instead of cares. I use the American Standard. It's an old version. But anxiety is good. You're anxious for your spouse. You're anxious for your family, for your kids. And I think that Paul's kind of overstating this, because think about this in this congregation. What if everybody was single and they were... There were many kids, right? And so I think as an elder in a congregation, I like seeing new babies being born and kids growing up and Bible classes and just seeing the development. And not many people will probably be attracted to a church that was composed all of single people, unless they were single looking for getting ready to mingle. But because of the present distress, what's going on, he's not saying to divorce. He's saying if you're married, stay married. But it might be better to not marry because of some circumstances are going to be coming about in the world at that time. Okay, verse 35. This I say, or I say these things for your own profit, not that I may cast a snare upon you, but for that which is seemly, that you may attend upon the Lord without distraction or cares or anxiety. But if any man thinks that, and this is a little challenging to interpret, if any man thinks that he behaves himself unseemly toward his virgin daughter, if she be past the flower of her age, and if need so requires, let him do what he will. He sins not, let them marry. I don't know what that means. but remember, in those days and times, the father had a lot of power. And it might be that the daughter's older. The time has come and passed when she should have been married. And maybe some people are pointing fingers at that father. And maybe she wants to get married. And he's always said no. You can't get married. So Paul's saying here, in that sort of situation, rather than people whispering and saying things that are improper, making judgments that aren't right, let the daughter marry. And he may be thinking that, well, there's some distress that's coming. And Paul said that it's better not to marry. But there's got to be some flexibility in here, and circumstances may dictate that he needs to let his daughter get married. We don't live in times like that. Yes,
Several other versions indicate it's more of a relationship with a man and his betrothed or his fiance or his...
Not a virgin, not his virgin daughter.
Right.
What version says that?
ESV, ERV.
I may need to take a look at that. Some translations then give the interpretation of the translator. Some versions are more exacting in their translation. That's why I like the American Standard. But here, and that may be right, but my version talks about the virgin daughter. Verse 37, but he that stands, talking about a father, he that stands steadfast in his heart, having no necessity, but hath power as touching his own will, and hath determined this in his own heart, to keep his own virgin daughter, shall do well. So it's really talking about sort of a social dilemma that doesn't really apply to us. Because parents generally don't have a whole lot of power once the daughter sets her hat on a young man to try to control that, right? Right, and so there, yes, and so is that a little hypocritical? I mean, I don't know, and so again, it's so hard to interpret, and so sometimes I think if there's a time machine, so many places I'd like to go, but just to see what the circumstances were in those days, so that we can interpret this better. And so we're kind of at the outside looking in, reading somebody else's mail, right? But the bottom line for us is that in this whole thing is that Christians need to be married for the whole lives. If something happens, adultery or anything else, and you divorce, remain unmarried. That's the bottom line in all this. And verse 39, again, I repeat this, wife is bound for as long time as her husband lives, and which is taught other places too. But if the husband be dead, she is free to be married to whom she will, only in the Lord. We'll talk about that more later. Verse 38, so then both he that giveth his own virgin daughter in marriage, he does well. He that gives her not in marriage shall do better, because in Paul's mind, because of the present distress, people need to remain single. So when you're in the face of persecution, the persecutors can't use your husband or your wife or your kids to cause you to reject the Lord, which could shift you into Satan's camp and you'd be punished eternally. So this verse 39, once the husband dies, she's free to be married to whom she will, only in the Lord. And a lot of people, or some people, interpret this to mean that she can only marry another Christian. David Smithman taught me that when you see in the Lord, in the Spirit, in God, that means in a relationship with the Lord. Substitute thinking in your brain in a relationship with the Lord. And that could just mean then that you have to follow the rules that he's already stated. That once you marry, you remain married for life. I don't know of a Christian widow, I'm sure they exist, that would want to be married to anybody but a Christian. And I know certainly my mother was that way. My dad had been dead 5 years, and she found a fellow who was a Christian, elder in the Lord's church. And there's a lot of joy in marriage if you're not constantly bickering about what church you need to be going to and things like that. So I think usually when a woman or a man are older, got a little more wisdom, not driven by hormones and impulses, and think that if I really want to be happy, and it may be that I don't want to get married again, but if I really want to be happy, I'm going to get married to another Christian who believes like I do and has faith just like I do. Yes, Walker?
You know, the first time I met Daryl Roberts, who's the man that married my grandmother, my grandfather died, it was really impressive that they both had these scriptures in mind and had followed them long and hard. And, like, the first thing that Daryl did when I got there really was pull me aside and start laying out these scriptures and explaining why they were getting married and why that seemed to be happening so quickly.
Yeah. You know, Mom, she called me. She never had met Daryl Roberts. He lived in Oklahoma. But they had some friends there at church in Houston that connected them together. And so they were calling each other and trading pictures and all this stuff, you know. And then Mother invited him to come to Houston for a gospel meeting. And he decided to come. Well, you and I know this. He wasn't coming for a gospel meeting. And so she called me and said, I said, Rob, Daryl's coming this weekend. I'd like you to come meet him. Well, I had plans that weekend. I said, well, Mother, let this relationship develop a little bit, and if he seems like he's the one, I'll be glad to come meet him. She said, well, we're talking about getting married. I said, Mother, you've never met him. And she goes, well, we know each other, and we don't have a whole lot of time, you know, and all that. And I said, Mother, all you've seen is pictures. I said, he could have a big old cancer going on the back of his neck. He might have the breath that would stop a charging rhino. I'm not going to come. And so she called me. He came, and she called me and said, Daryl wants to come to Corpus Christi to meet you. Somehow he thought, at me being the oldest son, that I had some sort of power. Wish I did. And Mother would have been so much better if she not had my two brothers. So I said, well, Mom, I was going to come and surprise you, but if Daryl wants to come down here, yeah, I'll meet him. But I've been so Daryl wasn't anything like my dad, real nervous sort, you know. And he come down in the morning like he was dressing ready to go to church, and and the prayer before a meal took 5 minutes, and and the first thing he did was he real nervous, but he said, "Rob, I want to talk to you." So we went outside, and we talked. What do you have against me and your mother getting married? I go, well, you don't know each other very well. And I said, I think there's some things to be thought of, you know, like if Mother died, what would happen to family treasures that may not have no intrinsic value but are worth the world to me and my brothers. And then later on during the day, my youngest brother Greg and I were talking to Mom. I'll never forget this. And she said, we really need to get married because we have a yearning for each other. hold some things back, Mom. So, anyway, and so when we look at this verse, a woman is bound to her husband as long as he lives. But if he does, she's free. It took Mother 5 years, thank God. I didn't think she was ever going to remarry. I was in my 40s, and I thought, well, Mom will just be, you know, single. But then when I turned 60, which was how old she was when my dad died, and I turned 60, and I thought, how stupid I was. You know, 60 is still pretty young. And Paul concludes in verse 40. But she's happier if she abide as she is after my judgment, and I think that I also have the Spirit of God. So Paul's judgment was that there's going to be some things and circumstances that were going to happen. His advice is to remain single. He goes, but I don't want y'all fornicating, so if you need to get married, get married. Thank you for your attention.